content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the May 2024 edition of Education Today. The first article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, "Dartmouth's Leader Called in Police Quickly. The Fallout Was Just as Swift." Local law enforcement went in just a couple of hours after a protest encampment went up. By Vimal Patel, posted May 13, 2024. As the police arrested student protesters at Dartmouth College, a 65-year-old professor ended up on the ground. Two student journalists reporting that night ended up arrested themselves. And a bystander, visiting his father who lives near Dartmouth, found himself with a fractured shoulder. That was some of the collateral damage after the president of Dartmouth College, Shion Leah Baylock, took unusually swift action and authorized the police action on May 1 to clear an encampment that students had just 2 hours earlier pitched on the college green. Dr. Baylock, a cognitive scientist who studies why people choke under pressure, has been facing a campus uproar ever since. Presidents have faced a platter of unappealing choices in handling the student encampments, which have recently popped up all over the country to protest Israel's war in Gaza. A few colleges, like Northwestern University, struck agreements with their student protesters and found themselves criticized for being too lenient. Others, like Wesleyan University, said protesters would face discipline, but that officials would not use force to clear the tents if students remained nonviolent. And at places like University of Chicago, administrators had warned against the encampments and watched them enlarge over days before calling in the police. Dartmouth College has stood out for its almost instantaneous response to a nonviolent protest. Students there erected the tents at about 6:45 p.m., protectively surrounded by more than 100 supporters linking arms. After warnings to leave, campus safety officials deferred to the Hanover Police Department, the New Hampshire State Police, and other local agencies. Arrests began around 8:50 p.m. In an email the day after the arrests, Dr. Baylock said that allowing the university's shared spaces to be taken over for ideological reasons is, quote, "exclusionary at best and, at its worst, as we have seen on other campuses in recent days, can turn quickly into hateful intimidation where Jewish students feel unsafe." Moshe L. Gray, the longtime executive director of the Dartmouth chapter of Chabad, an Orthodox Jewish group, said Dr. Baylock has taken, quote, "a very principled stand since October 7th, making her stand out from her Ivy peers. She has an obligation to keep the school safe," Rabbi Gray said. "Jewish students feel like she has done that for them." But to some faculty members, using law enforcement to arrest nonviolent protesters broke the compact that should exist on college campuses. "We're supposed to be a living example for how we manage divisive topics, and the most important thing in this process is that we don't engage each other as enemies," said Udi Greenberg, a history professor. "Sending the police on protesters is the exact opposite of engaging each other in good faith." There was also the matter of injuries. Andrew Teft, visiting his dad from out of town, took a walk to the green as the police moved in. He said he was unconnected to the college or the protesters, so when an officer ordered him to move, he was confused. "I guess I was done enough to say where," Mr. Teft, 45, said in an interview. "I feel my phone get knocked out of my hands and go flying, and I feel my arms getting pulled. I feel the metal cuffs go on. I was like, oh, I'm being arrested." He said he fractured his shoulder during a scuffle with the police. An arrest report said that Mr. Teft did not comply with orders and behaved aggressively during the arrest. "I grew up in this town," said Mr. Teft, who has fond memories of watching bonfires on the green. "And this is the craziest story that's ever happened to me." Annalise Orlick, the former head of Jewish studies at the university, said she started taking videos of the arrests when she was knocked to the ground as she tried to grab her phone from a police officer. Alessandra Gonzalez, a student reporter, witnessed the professor's arrest. Then she, too, was arrested. She called out to another student reporter, Charlotte Hampton, a news managing editor who also ended up zip-tied. In an interview, both said they had press identification. Local and state police officials did not agree to interview requests. The last time so many campuses resorted to the police to confront student protesters was 1970, during the anti-war movement, said David Farber, an American history professor at the University of Kansas who has studied the 1960s. Students then were far more militarized than today, he said, noting that they firebombed campus buildings across the country. "What's different about this period is there's been so many confrontations so fast, so many administrators calling in the cops so quickly," he said. In the last month, more than 2,800 students have been arrested across the country. On May 6th, in a raucous online meeting with faculty, which quickly met the 500-person limit, Dr. Balock tried to explain her fast reaction. "An ongoing encampment is not something we can ensure the safety of," she said, "especially if people outside Dartmouth decide to join with their own agendas." She cited Columbia University, where some outsiders had joined the protests, but were certainly not in the majority. Many faculty were not appeased. They said that the violence came from the police, not the protesters. "Five tenths," wrote Carolyn Dever, a former Dartmouth provost, in the comments of the chat as Dr. Balock spoke, which was repeated by many faculty members. "This is not Columbia," another faculty member wrote. "Drop the charges," wrote another. Matthew J. Garcia, a history professor, said Dartmouth used a big city solution for the serene rural town of Hanover. "It's like a place out of time," he said, adding, "it is absurd to suggest that this is a hotbed of revolution." The student newspaper also criticized the university in an editorial, demanding that the university urge the authorities to drop the charges against their reporters. "The college should be embarrassed," it stated. "We expect a prompt and public apology from College President Shian Leah Balock." University administrators responded defiantly at first, saying they supported the students' reporters' right to clear their names, quote, "through the legal process." But as the backlash grew, and press freedom supporters slammed the university, Dr. Balock relented, stating in a column in the student newspaper that the reporter should not have been arrested. "We are working with local authorities to ensure this error is corrected," she wrote. The charges against the reporters were dropped. Some on campus may not be demand her resignation angry. In a measure perhaps of the high social cost of supporting Dr. Balock, the student council voted publicly for a no-confidence measure, 13-2, with 3 abstaining. After the student body president vetoed the public vote, citing inadequate deliberation, another vote, held privately, reversed the decision, 9-8 against, with 2 abstaining. The entire student body is now voting on a no-confidence measure. The faculty is divided. "Our president is Jewish herself and has been on top of how Jewish students are feeling on the campus," said Sergei Khan, an anthropology professor. He said students at the protest were chanting offensive, quote, borderline anti-Semitic slogans like, quote, "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Many supporters of the Palestinians say the phrase is a rallying cry for the dignity of Palestinians. When they surrounded the tents and held hands, they were ready for a fight, Dr. Khan said, adding that the green, quote, belongs to all of us. Dartmouth's board has also supported the action. Liz Kale Lempres, Dartmouth's board chair, said in an email to the Times that she had spoken with all board members and, quote, each one unequivocally supports Dr. Baylock. In any case, the arrests may not deter the protesters. Months before tents became a symbol of pro-Palestinian activism on college campuses nationwide, Kevin Engel and other students set up two outside the Dartmouth administration building to seek divestment from Israel. Mr. Engel, a first-year student, and another student were arrested on a trespassing charge, an early sign that Dr. Baylock was serious about cracking down on policy violators. Dr. Baylock's decision, Mr. Engel said, turbocharged the student activists. We're not going to stop, he said. Palestine will be free within our lifetimes. The students are taking up the burden of doing that work because no one else really is. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, One School Leader Banned Cell Phones, the Other Embraced Them. What Worked? By Ariana Prothero, posted May 14th, 2024. Many educators will tell you that cell phones are a source of serious academic, mental health, and behavioral problems for students. And school leaders are struggling to figure out how to deal with the cell phone problem, especially as younger and younger students get their own devices. Developing a workable school cell phone policy is no easy task, as major constituents are often at odds. Teachers may want them gone, while students want unfettered access to them. Parents are often divided, with some wanting to minimize distractions in class, while others like the security of being able to reach their kids during the school day. In response to these challenges, Education Week reached out to two school leaders, one in a school that requires students to lock their phones up all day, and the other in a school that encourages students to use their phones for learning in class. Both leaders claim that their approaches are working. Subheading: A middle school ban because cell phones were, quote, the ultimate distraction. Charles Longshore is the assistant principal of Dothan Preparatory Academy in Dothan, Alabama. His school serves 1,200 7th and 8th grade students. Longshore said that while he sees academic value in cell phones, he also sees that life has placed a lot of hurdles in front of his students, and that cell phones had become another one getting in the way of learning. We often have kids who are 7th graders who are functioning academically at 2nd and 3rd grade levels, and we're trying to jump them ahead academically, he said. Cell phones weren't just a distraction in Dothan classrooms. They were seriously undermining the school's climate, said Longshore. Students were arguing more, and Longshore said increasing amounts of his time was spent managing discipline referrals. A particular thorn in Dothan administrators' sides was an anonymous Instagram account that had been created to spread school rumors, he said. We were never able to figure out who created it. Instagram would not help us. We appealed to them to take it down, and they never would, he said. It was students saying, so-and-so did this, or so-and-so did that, or has this condition. And they would post pictures. They might be like, look at what she's wearing, snapping a picture of them in gym. Is it feasible for us to stop and check 150 kids in PE to see who took the photo? Problems that arise from cell phones and social media are difficult to police, Longshore said. It's often one student's word against another, or one student's complaint against an anonymous person who posted something online. Longshore said that adolescents have unique developmental struggles that made the situation in his school untenable. Self-management is one of our biggest concerns. I think COVID had a lot to do with that, he said. Not having that structure, I think, played a role. But our population being in that rough transitional phase in their lives in general, what their minds are going through, their bodies are going through, socially what they are going through, cell phones were the ultimate distraction. That's why administrators at Dauphin decided to bar students from using cell phones during the school day starting this school year. Students place their cell phones in individual lockboxes in their homerooms at the beginning of the day. Their homeroom teacher keeps the key to each lockbox. Students return to their homeroom for the last class period and retrieve their phones a few minutes before the final bell. That way, Longshore said, students have their phones for after-school activities and to walk home, which makes parents more comfortable. There are caveats to the policy, said Longshore. A few students with special needs, like those with diabetes, who use their phone to monitor their blood sugar levels, can keep their devices throughout the day. The majority of parents support the policy now, and students have come to accept it, said Longshore. The biggest challenge with the cell phone policy came before it was enacted, Longshore said. When they announced it last summer, there was pushback and a lot of misinformation. But it was nothing a couple of community forums couldn't smooth over, he said. The results have been extremely promising, Longshore said. He can see tangible improvements to the school's climate. Behavioral referrals have gone down by about 20%, and he believes he will see improvements in students' academic performance as well, once state test results are released. Longshore doesn't think Dauphin's cell phone policy is the answer for every school. High school students, for example, may be mature enough to manage their own cell phone use, and having the devices in class could be beneficial for some classroom assignments. But for his middle schoolers, Longshore believes this policy is the right one. Subheading: A high school that encourages students to use cell phones as learning tools. In Douglas County, Colorado, Chris Page is the principal of Highlands Ranch High School, which serves about 1,400 students. In his school, students are allowed to use their phones throughout the day and are even encouraged to do so. Page had tried banning cell phones at one point, he said, but that lasted for only about a month. There are 100,000 ways that kids use their cell phones, and the other half of this is that it's hard to tell a kid not to use their cell phone when the adult in front of them has to use theirs, he said. We decided we just weren't going to fight that fight anymore. Page encourages teachers to use student cell phones as tools in their teaching. The school provides periodic professional development throughout the year to teachers on how they can leverage the devices in their instruction, whether it be to have students look up additional information in class, access materials, use online calculators, or make videos for class projects. From science teachers to music teachers, cell phones present a lot of helpful opportunities for educators, Page said. We use it in our choir. Our choir teacher now makes it a recommendation that the kids have to find their pitch on their own without using the piano. They use their phone to play a G or B chord for them, Page said. It's allowed us a little more freedom in our teaching space. In our school, we have 2 outdoor classrooms, so it's given us more freedom to teach in better, more unique spaces instead of trapped in the classroom with all of the Chromebooks, because that's the only technology we have. The cell phone policy isn't a total free-for-all, Page emphasized. Even though teachers are encouraged to find uses for students' cell phones, they ultimately have the authority to make the rules for their own classrooms and can tell students to put away their phones at any time, Page said. If kids use their phones inappropriately, such as a student ignoring a teacher who has asked for the phone to be put away, they get two warnings before the teacher is allowed to confiscate the phone. Students can retrieve it from Paige's office later. The school is also using more technology that requires students to have cell phones, said Paige. School administrators also frequently communicate important information to students on social media. For instance, all updates regarding this year's prom are posted on the school's Instagram account. Paige even hosted a school-wide scavenger hunt this year, where he dropped clues on Instagram. And the school is adopting digital ID badges, which will require students to use their phones, Paige said. The pandemic changed his school's relationship with technology. Just like most people in the country, technology became so much of a necessity, Paige said. When COVID hit, after our dive into technology, we chose not to come out of the pool, and we decided to keep utilizing the technology in our classrooms. Overall, Paige said the policy has been working well, even with some of the challenges it creates, such as kids constantly reaching out to their parents during the school day instead of taking their issues to the school counselor. The school also has to have a supply of iPads on hand for those students who forget their phones so they can still participate in class activities. And, Paige admits, cell phones can still cause distractions. He used an example of a student ordering lunch from Uber Eats during class. But, he said, the school hasn't descended into anarchy either. Only about 10 times a year, Paige estimates, do students get their cell phones taken away from them. The way Paige sees it is that cell phones are here to stay, and it's the job of a high school to teach students how to use them productively. We are in the business of preparing kids for the next step, he said. There aren't many college campuses that have no cell phones whatsoever. It's about responsible use, and we have a duty to teach kids about responsible use. The next article comes from the Washington Post.
This news story was written by Cleve R. Woodson Jr. and Holly Bailey. Biden trumpets progress for Black Americans in Detroit and at Morehouse College. A handful of students in Atlanta expressed their discontent over the president's policy on Israel, but no one interrupted his commencement speech. Detroit. President Biden pitched himself as a leader who is breaking down doors for Black Americans during a closely watched commencement speech on Sunday at Morehouse College, and an evening speech in Detroit to try to make inroads with a constituency that has drifted away from him in recent polls. Before Biden spoke at Morehouse, the biggest question was whether his words would be interrupted by protests, like the ones that have sprung up on college campuses across the country. But instead of a loud rebuke, Biden was met with polite, if measured, applause by the more than 400 graduating seniors and their families, and no major demonstrations. He focused his speeches on what he sees as his record of improving the lives of Black Americans, stressing that the strides would stop if Donald Trump were elected, a theme he returned to throughout the day. Sunday capped several days when Biden made an effort to draw on Black institutions and pivotal moments in Black history to contextualize the role his administration has played in the fight for racial equity. Those advancements, he said, could be jeopardized if voters choose Trump in November. Instead of forcing you to prove you're 10 times better, we're breaking down doors so you have 100 times more opportunities. Good-paying jobs you can raise a family on in your neighborhood, capital to start small businesses, loans to buy homes, health insurance, prescription drugs, housing that's more affordable, Biden said at Morehouse. A handful of students and faculty members at the ceremony turned their backs on Biden as he gave the keynote speech, a silent protest of the president's support of Israel's war in Gaza. As many as 6 students could be seen seated with their backs to Biden at one point, one with a fist raised in the air. At least one faculty member appeared to be doing the same thing. Biden recognized the protests and said he respected them. Let me be clear. I support peaceful, nonviolent protest. Your voices should be heard, and I promise I hear them, he said. Tensions have simmered on Morehouse's campus in recent weeks, as groups of students, faculty, and alumni at this historically Black all-male institution demanded that Biden's invitation be rescinded over his support of Israel. Many worried that allowing Biden to speak in this moment would mar the school's reputation and be antithetical to the teachings of its most famous graduate, Martin Luther King Jr. Both Georgia and Michigan are key battleground states, and polls point to a closely contested election. Biden touted historic investments in historically Black colleges and universities like Morehouse, and highlighted the diversity he has put in place at the highest levels of government. He said he was drawn into politics by the example of King, a bust of whom sits in the Oval Office. Biden also sought to contrast himself with Trump, his likely opponent in November's election, saying the former president and other Republicans would dismantle the progress that black Americans have made in the past 3 years. Gerald Butler, 21, who graduated Sunday with a degree in art, said in an interview that he was not happy at all, thinking about the upcoming presidential election, and that Biden's Morehouse appearance had done nothing to change his lack of enthusiasm or his indecision. It was a nice gesture, of course, but I kind of already knew he was going to come in and give a performative speech regarding the election under the guise of pushing us forward to the future and doing our best, Butler said, adding, "It's kind of a continuous pattern that the Democrats usually do when they need the black vote, and then they disappear. It's kind of upsetting, but it is what it is." A few hours later in Detroit, Biden faced a much friendlier crowd. He was the keynote speaker at the Detroit NAACP's Freedom Fund dinner, and took the stage to chant of 4 more years, before introducing himself as a lifetime member of the NAACP, and he almost immediately launched into a list of things his administration has delivered for black Americans: historic lows of black unemployment, and historic highs of African Americans with access to health insurance. He told the crowd the racial wealth gap was its lowest in 2 decades. "All that progress is at risk. Trump is trying to make everyone forget how dark everything was while he was president," Biden said. "Ask yourself, if he's elected, who do you think he'll put on the Supreme Court?" In Detroit and Atlanta, he reminded audiences of what happened on January 6, 2021, after a pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the certification of the 2020 election results. "Insurrectionists who storm the Capitol with Confederate flags are called patriots by some. Not in my house," Biden said at Morehouse. He also reminded the Morehouse, "Black police officers, black veterans protecting the Capitol were called another word, as you'll recall." In Detroit, he implied Trump's reaction to the attacks was motivated by racial bias. "What do you think he would have done if on January 6th, black Americans had stormed the Capitol?" Biden asked. Biden has spent most of the past week intensifying his outreach to black voters, one of the Democratic Party's most loyal constituencies, as recent polls show softening support from the demographic. Some black voters are saying they are inclined to not vote at all, and many are less enthusiastic about voting for Biden than they were 4 years ago. On Thursday, Biden met with plaintiffs in the 1954 Supreme Court case Brown v. Board of Education, which outlawed school segregation in the United States. On Friday, he met with members of the Divine Nine historically black sororities and fraternities. A day before that, during a speech marking the 70th anniversary of Brown, Biden said Trump and his allies would curb voting rights and gut affirmative action on college campuses. The threat of demonstrations and a potentially public rebuke of Biden made his trip to Atlanta a closely watched one.
And we'll have to cut that article short for time.
We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.